Welcome everyone to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about, you guessed it, board games. I'm here with my good friend Mark. My name is Michael Walker, and today we are going to talk about the game reviewed exactly 1 year ago, and then some games we played that last week, some news and why it totally doesn't matter, and then the topic of the week, which is the one that broke the Calyx's back.
We're just going to leave you in suspense as to what on earth that means. That might give you, in that moment of confusion, some notion, some vague idea of what it is like to have to speak regularly to Michael Walker.
Just so.
So the Aeurus, the as-yet-unnamed retrospective intro segment, the game we reviewed 1 year ago. What did we review last year, Walker?
It was Heroescape.
Yes!
Which was so weird. It's such a high episode count. I know we talked about it in like sort of games we played that week.
Yes.
But the fact that we didn't do a full review on it so late was so weird.
Because there was the noise about various attempts to resurrect Heroescape. And Renegade Games is actually bringing it back legit in all its pre-painted glory, although now it is very much not the big box delight that it was before, the sort of Walmartish bagatelle.
Yeah, it's not like we're going to produce millions of these, so it will be $3.
Exactly. That and certain economic conditions have changed, and so pre-painted miniatures just aren't really economically feasible at mass scale anymore. And consequently, the master set was very, very expensive, the new one that they're putting out. It hasn't come out yet. I'm curious.
So long story short, Heroescape is a skirmishing game that came out in big box stores that was unit-based. You bought all these units. It was like sort of, I wouldn't say it's based on, but if you've ever watched first generation Star Trek, the one time they were teleported down to a planet and they had two factions that were made up of people from history, and this is what sort of like Heroescape is. There's like units, musketeer men and aliens and robots and dinosaurs and orcs, you name it. It's like this hodgepodge of whatever you want. So you purchase these units and then you fight against the other person and you make this intricate puzzle sort of battletech landscape that has water and palm trees and snow and lava, you name it. It's a great toy. It came out with two big master sets that you could buy. Like the second one came out far after the first, of course. And then they came out with a plethora of unit packs that you could buy. And it ranged from anywhere, you know, bring in your special Marvel packs, your D&D packs, your packs of everything else. And this is Heroescape.
And it's actually a really solid skirmish system. It's not the best, but it is very good. And given that the toy factor is through the roof, I absolutely do not regret the fact that I still have a very, very large tub full of Heroescape stuff. And we don't play it nearly as often as we would like, largely because it's a real pain to set up. Some people enjoy setting it up, but even the people who enjoy setting it up, it's very, very involved. And ultimately, I don't know to what extent I'm going to engage with the new Heroescape stuff. I'm still very curious, but we'll see.
There was a midterm set, too, and it wasn't terrible. They sort of lent magic the sort of properties that was Heroescape, and they came out with, was it called Planeswalker? And it had a title of something, but pretty well fundamentally used the same, you know, base as Heroescape.
With some deck construction.
A little bit of, yeah, magic in there. And it played, it was great as well. It didn't have the variety.
It was okay, yeah. It's tough. I mean, if the starter set doesn't catch on, you'll never really know what the system can do, because without the level of customization, you feel like you're losing a lot. And the terrain was just cardboard, with a couple of very minor exceptions. And the units were not pre-painted. And so it was visually discordant, not compatible with the rest of Heroescape stuff. And consequently, it never really caught on. But Hasbro put out a number of things that could have potentially been interesting. Like, that was the same era, roughly the same era, as their sci-fi battleship game with these big science fiction cruisers that would go. Unfortunately, the rules were really a letdown. But sadly, we cannot choose what games get supported and what games don't get supported. Do you know why Star Trek used to pull all that stuff, Walker? Why there were all those episodes where, like, now we're in ancient Rome, now there are some Nazis, now we're doing gangsters?
Well, probably they had the sets available.
They had the sets of the costumes available, which, yeah, whatever was available in the Paramount lot. And so word came down from on high, write an episode where it's all gangsters. And they're like, okay. And then they have to write an episode that was all gangsters. That's how you make sci-fi on the cheap.
Yes.
And you have access to a bunch of sets and lots. Anyway, but that was a good pull. I think that's a good sort of situation to think. Heroescape, We love us some HeroScape, even though we do not get to play it nearly as often as we would like. More on that later, I suspect, on our topic. So, now on to the games we played last week. Walker, what did you play last week?
Oh, Mark, I played Uprising, Curse of the Last Emperor. This is put out by Nemesis Games, designed by Cornelius Kremen, Powell Meyer, and Dirk Sommer. And it was sort of like a what game. I had two friends that come over that don't come over very often. We play a lot of video games. And there's a big sort of surgence in this new Helldivers game. And so I've been talking to them a lot lately and said, hey, we all have this free time. And so I searched my brain. What game do I want to introduce new players? Not new players. They play a lot of board games. But what's, you know, this game I really enjoy that I want to share to them? And Huey and I decided that we're going to show them Uprising. What Uprising is sort of like a pandemic co-op-y game where you're choosing one of a plethora of factions and you're building troops on a map and you're defending from chaos trying to swarm into the middle and the empire trying to return their land back. So it's this units coming from the middle, units coming from the outside, and everyone's army sort of in the middle, trying to help each other out, trying to build units, trying to put out havens, getting items, going on quests, rolling a ridiculous amount of dice.
Oh, I remember the dice.
These really interesting sort of acrylic standees instead of miniatures.
Lovely standees, yeah.
I love it. I love everything about it.
So, Walker, I believe you made some threat of telling me about the boards for your boards.
Boards for my boards. Oh, yeah. So there's so much, you know, now, like I said, tons of factions. And they, even with the second Kickstarter came out, they had these new player boards that you have now. So you have this nice little setup where you have a place to put all your resources and your player board and stand up your cards.
Because heaven forfend, you put the little wood tokens on the table. That would just be...
That would be garbage.
Sheer chaos.
Gross. And like you said, there was a problem with the dice. So now that they upgraded the druid system, so now we have tokens for your dice. And what I wanted to wait to comment on was the fact, I think in our very first games, we just had a lot of bad luck. And that happens sometimes.
It's true. And if a game, hypothetically, is almost entirely driven by luck, then that might lead a hypothetical game to feel somewhat unsatisfying, arbitrary, and...
True. So there's the dice. And then we talked about, in this very recent game, the order in which the tiles are turned over. Because it is very sort of browbeaty, which is in a cooperative game. This is what happens, right? So you send out your leader and he flips over a terrain tile and bad things can happen. If you flip over certain tiles right near the beginning, as opposed to in the mid game, then it's really going to change up how the game plays. You might get very unlucky and get very difficult tiles right off the start, which sure. I think we might have got in our first game or so. Same thing with some of the quests have immediate effects, and this happened in the game we just played. The first three quests that came up were all immediate effects, so we got a lot of bad things off the beginning, but we still pulled it through at the end.
Oh, good for you.
And the other thing I like about it, we've talked about some games recently as well as the difficulty rating, so this has like a huge scale of making things more difficult, and it's very easy to do. There's just a whole side of cards that I haven't even touched yet that are in bags that you just sort of filter in to make the game harder, which is going to happen now because we have won a lot.
Can't have that.
No. That is Uprising, Curse of the Last Emperor.
Yeah, I still maintain that I'll try it with the Druids once. I do want to like it. You know, the overall structure is sort of, and this isn't a perfect analogy, but it's kind of like a co-op Eclipse in that it is a vaguely 4X-y kind of sort of thing with lots of troops on a map elements. And indeed, when you were talking about flipping up tiles, it's like, oh, well, that was very unlucky. You know, that also reminded me very much of Eclipse, because that, I think, is one of the aspects of Eclipse that we hate the most.
Yeah, so like when Mark said, there's a whole new Druid system. And so you deal out these cards, and they come with crystals. And sort of at the end of a round, you sort of see if any of these thresholds have met. Like, are there this many of this thing out or this? So a bunch of thresholds. And if you've hit those thresholds, then it says to add crystals to these cards. And then at any time, you can use these crystals to reroll all of the dice that you might want, that you've made for a particular roll. The other thing they sort of changed is a lot of the mercenaries and some of the units now have these metallic dice. There's bronze, silver, and gold, and some of the sides have stars on them, and the stars you can make whatever symbol you want. So you can sort of use that to sort of, you know, fix your bad luck. And we'll see. Hopefully it makes it bearable for you.
Yeah, I'd be down to try those things. There are a lot of things in Uprising that I like. So that is Uprising Curse of the Last Emperor. I get to play two sessions back-to-back of Zuvadis. I seldom am interested in playing a game back-to-back, but when it is quick and when it is as good as Zuvadis, I was more than happy to oblige. This is by Rainer Knizia. This is a Bitewing Games kind of redevelopment of Quo Vadis, which was published in the 20th century, if you would believe that. Still sounds strange saying it that way, but then again, I am what you would call an aging millennial. At any rate, Zuvadis is a marvelous negotiation game, and it really emphasizes that a good negotiation game has enough grist for negotiation, but not necessarily so much that it's going to get overwhelming if you want to pitch it at this level. What I mean is, not every negotiation game has to be like Citadel Confluence, because a lot of people who are ill-inclined towards negotiation, if they get dropped in such an environment, their natural response might be to clam up or tense up or somehow cause the game to grind to a halt. It's not a very fragile game, but, you know, some games are better for different people. And Zuvadis, in this particular play session, a number of people there commented that they are more accustomed to sort of multiplayer solitaire Euros. And I was entirely confident that Zuvadis would nonetheless work. And it did. One of the tricks that it does, if you'll recall from our review, is that you have a couple of instances of use of a special power, which may not be used for you. And it is little touches like that that I really appreciate in trading negotiation games. You know, Senji did this in spades. Senji is still one of my all-time favorite games. And in Senji, you have all these diplomatic cards that cannot be used on your behalf. And so they are only useful for trading. And stuff like that is great grist and great impetus and a great nudge for people to engage in some deal making. That having been said, I think I might have escalated things unreasonably, Walker. You'll probably recognize this set of behaviors from me. So we were having a fine, friendly game of Zuvadis. I'll vote for you if you vote for me. I'll vote for you if you give me some points. It's like, oh, maybe a little more points. Okay, maybe a little more points. Or, oh, I don't think I'll pay more. It's like, okay, well, we'll talk later. About three quarters of the way through one of the games, I pointed to a juncture and I say, pay me a point or I will take this move to harm you.
What? Now, Mark, you bullied someone? No.
Okay, bully is a strong... Okay, yeah, this was bullying. Now, look, in my defense, right, I had already gotten to the last chamber. In Zuvadis, you cannot win unless you progress to the last chamber. I'd already gotten to the last chamber. And so I had nothing left to do. There were no actions for me to take that seemed directly of benefit to me. So I figured...
It's time to bully for some points.
Well, look, the unalternative, and I mean this sincerely, I'll accept the title bully, fine. Unalternative would have been, and I've seen people do this, and this I think is more toxic to a negotiation game, I hear we're going to teach the controversy, would be to look at the board state, identify who their biggest threat was, and just do a thing to harm somebody.
Yeah, if they too had not made it yet, then yeah, make it difficult for them to make it.
Right, right. And some people would say, well, I'm not going to like, extortion is nasty, I'm just going to hit someone instead. And I'm like, I think in a negotiation game, extortion is preferable to assault. I mean this sincerely, like, pay me a point or I will do this thing that harms you. I think in a negotiation game is much more pro-social and much more engaging in the spirit and the rules and the dynamics of the game than just figuring, what will hurt someone the most and then going and doing that. Are you willing to back me up on
I
that?
I am. But okay. You could word it differently, like you know,
I was trying to phrase it as least.
You could phrase it. You say, you might want to give me a point because in theory, in an alternate universe, probably this one, I might do this thing. See, you can make it sound nicer.
What about lovely board position, shame if something happened to it.
Just so.
While gesturing with a firebomb.
Yeah, that's okay. The way.
Yeah, okay, I'll grant you that possibly my pitch could have been better, but I made the threat, or rather the offer. It depends on how you want to phrase it. I'm inclined to phrase it non-charitably towards myself, because I feel a little bit bad about the entire way that I went down. I made the offer / threat, and there was like a pause, and then someone says, can you do that? I was like, yeah, we're allowed to trade points at any time, and I'm saying, if you don't, I'm going to use my turn to do this thing. It wasn't like I was saying, give me a point or I will do this action that I had not yet explained, right? That would have been unacceptable, right? It's like, I'm introducing this new mechanism and I will bludgeon you with it unless you bribe me. No. This was, look, well, this is one of the options that I have. This is an option that I assume you really don't want me to take. So give me a point to convince me to do something else. Anyway. Do I feel bad? Not really. I feel a little bit guilty, but I do feel it is within the spirit of the game. It was an escalation, though. And perhaps that was not the greatest idea.
A different shade of the game.
Definitely a different shade of the game. But nonetheless, I do want to emphasize, Zuvadis is an excellent game for an approachable entry-level negotiation game. There's enough there to satisfy gamers. I really think it's one of those great Knizia crossover all the way from intro. It's got those cutesy animals, those adorable marmosets and armadillos. And it allows for cutthroat negotiation if you want it to. And so I think it's a great canvas and very, very good for lots of different mixed groups. Zuvadis, very happy to get it back to the table. Had a great time. Reiner Knizia, 2023, Bitewing Games.
Speaking of Reiner Knizia in 2023, you were nice enough to show me a game called Marabunta. This is Reiner Knizia saying, well, you said there's not enough conflict in Roll and Rights. Here, hold my calculator. So this is put up by Space Cowboys, and this is yet another hidden gem, like a gnar sort of fantastic game in a small box, like gnar. It has these great sort of wipe and write boards that you put out, and it is a sort of troops on a map. I don't want to say troops on a map. It is area control where you're rolling the dice. You split, I choose.
Or I split, you choose.
I split,
or
you choose.
Or you split, I choose.
Back and forth. And you're writing different parts of the map. You're getting cupcakes. You're getting crates. You're taking over parts of the territory. There's five different sections of the map. And there are five colored dice to represent those sections, and you're either writing numbers in those sections or you're taking a victory flag for that section, depending on the dice that group that you picked. And then at the end of the game, when it's all over, whoever has the highest value in an area will win that area, and depending on how many flags they of that area they've colored in, they're going to get that many points. Overall, I thought it was a fantastic game.
So Reiner Knizia has arguably been doing Roll and Rights before Roll and Rights were a thing. You know, there's this famous print-and-play decathlon athletic-themed dice game, which is very much in the classic roll-and-write mold 20 years before that mold got finalized, in that it's you're mostly filling out a spreadsheet trying to get the highest number possible. Fair enough. And he sometimes engages in games that are very, very reminiscent of that in a variety of ways. We talked about Cascadito last week, and I definitely felt that Cascadito was definitely more of the more derivative, forgettable end of Roll and Rights. But Reiner Knizia also sometimes does things like the Medici Roll and Write, which is less a Roll and Write and more an auction game driven by dice. And then we have Marabunta. I'd been wanting to try Marabunta for a while. It's been recommended to us by a number of our listeners. And it's very much a Roll and Write for people who don't like Roll and Writes, as well as the I Split You Choose for people who don't like I Split You Choose. Because in terms of its roll and rightness, it is incredibly confrontational. I think you're right to identify that it has vague vibes of a troops on a map, because the way territory works and the way you expand your presence feels like drawing out battle lines in a lot of ways. You have a number of very limited opportunities to jump territory. If you wanted to retheme that as paratroopers, you could, honestly. And the rest of the time, you're steadily expanding your territory, which in turn influences the I split you choose. For example, say you get a very, very good result on the yellow die in the yellow territory, and you look over and you see that your opponent has nothing next to the yellow territory and is not able to expand there reasonably. You might therefore think, okay, I can safely sock this with other things and pocket this as a guaranteed bonus, or at the very least make it so it's useless for them. And that really informs the I split you choose, because very often in I split you choose games, the splitter doesn't really get any benefits. The structure is the splitter just has the opportunity to make mistakes, and the people who choose get to benefit from those mistakes. I've encountered this in a game called Dragon Valley, which was previously my favorite I Split You Choose game, largely because of the absurd dexterity mini challenges that it came with as a Kickstarter bonus. I felt this was true of New York Slice or with Cream, the pie version. Pies are not a good confection. I don't think people should be making board games about them. Cookies are far preferable. But anyway, in Marabunta, it felt like both players had an advantage. And so it was really interesting as a consequence. The player order also mattered, because the salient advantage that the chooser had wasn't even just in choosing the dice. It's that they get to go first with those dice. Marabunta's marvelous. I think it's one of the best two-player-only games we've played this side of David Thompson for quite some time. Parenthetically, it's been about 6 months, David Thompson. I think you're overdue for a brilliant game. This is like...
We're sending mixed messages, Mark.
Yeah.
We're like always going slow down, and now you're telling them.
I think 5 months is a good interval.
Okay.
When he's doing it all the time and every 3 months, that's too much. Too much.
It's funny that you bring him up, because I sort of have to apologize to Ryan Knizia, because I got angry because I asked you, because you didn't tell me who designed it. We were all done.
Yes. We finished the game.
And I said, who designed this? Because it was that same, because you said David Thomas, because it was that same sort of feeling. It's like, oh my God, this is.
I am angry at how good this is.
Yes. I'm excited, because if this is a new designer, then we can we can hope for new great things.
Sure.
And then it was Ryan Knizia. It's like, oh. So I do apologize. It is fine.
No, I hear exactly what you're saying. It and indeed, when I think about the output of Reiner Knizia, especially in some years in the late 90s, when I think about the output of David Thompson over the course of the past 4 years, I think an appropriate response is, where the hell do you get off? Who do you think you are? Anyway.
Just so.
It's good every once in a while, like the redevelopment of Zuvadas, like Marabunta, I would include Blue Lagoon in this. I would not include things like Babylonia, nor would I include Cascadero. But Reiner Knizia still got it. Like, he's not necessarily the same designer he was in the late 90s, but he's evolved. He's different. Quest for El Dorado, I put in the same category. People talk, and by people I include myself.
Don't forget about Llama Dice. I know.
We enjoy Llama Dice, but for what it is, as you would say. Maybe his best days are behind him. That's fine. But he still releases amazing games. And so I was very, very pleased to play Marabunta. And watching him riff on established ideas is always a joy. And Space Cowboys usually puts out a pretty good product. And the artist has delivered these very, very charming tableaus of ants doing anty things, sometimes in vaguely martial form. And in addition to other places, she studied in Montreal. So there you go.
There you go.
So I'm going to say that this is a Montreal design. That makes Reiner Knizia a Montreal designer.
Sure.
And no, he Montreal designer.
I said sure.
Yeah, okay. I'm glad
you
agree.
There was no sarcasm.
No sarcasm at all?
Yeah.
So the fact that your eyes were rolling outside of your skull, I should...
Yeah, totally backing you up and supporting you.
All right. Marabunta by Reiner Knizia, published by Space Cowboys in 2023. Got shown a game called Feed the Kraken. This is a social deduction game. It is a big box social deduction game in the context of a game that we talked about once called Among Cultists, a game I still very much want to go back to. Big box social deduction games are a bit of a strange niche product because a lot of people are somewhat wary of social deduction games, especially the longer and bigger they get. Whereas I'm perfectly happy to spend literally 2 to 3 hours arguing over a mission assignment in the Resistance. A lot of people don't want to do that. They want things quicker, more breezy. Don't worry, Feed the Kraken is still pretty quick and breezy. It's just in a big box with lots of plastic. So there you have it. That's definitely true of the deluxe version. I definitely get the vibe about halfway through Feed the Kraken that this could have very easily been a small box game with tokens and tiles. And you would have lost nothing. But alas, this is not the way things are going, and the market speaks the way the market does. Now, another way in which the market speaks is that the design idiom of social deduction games for the past few years, I think, have been very, very strongly influenced by Secret Hitler, in that they are less interested in producing an evolving social logic puzzle where people have to justify their actions and explain their understanding of the game state, and more interested in having that game state be influenced by the noise of random card draws. So in Secret Hitler, of course, the way that it works is people draw tiles and discard some and then hand them around. And you say, well, why did you do that? It's like, well, it's what I drew. And that's the kind of narrative you get over and over again. Why did you do that thing? I had to. It's what I drew. And Feed the Kraken is very much in that mold. You're trying to direct a ship, and where the ship ends up at the end of the game determines which side wins. On one side of the board is the pirates. On the other side of the board is the sailors, although pirates are also sailors, so what have you. And if it ends up right in the middle, driving through the Kraken's mouth, well, then the cultists win, because that's what the cultists want to do. They want to feed the Kraken. See? It's the title of the game, Walker.
Ooh,
yeah,
so
yeah.
So clever.
Yeah. And you have two individuals drawing some cards, ditching one, and then handing another individual a choice of two different cards. And so, sure enough, I only played it the once. A lot of, well, that's what I drew came up. And so I felt like there was an information state. There were player tells, absolutely. Looking back, I can reconstruct what happened and why. But playing as one of the good players, as it was very much a question of these terrible things are happening, and everyone's just claiming to have drawn terrible cards. And that doesn't give you a whole lot to work with, I find, when compared to other things, even when compared to something like Werewolf, frankly. And in a universe where Werewolf exists, I'm not often willing to say this, but I'm not really sure we need big box social deduction games that don't really add much to the formula. And there were some special abilities that never got used. There was a weird auction mechanism that seemed very, very high risk because it was a blind bid with resources that you don't get any more of. And so people were very cautious to do that. Now, granted, again, in hindsight, I could see why some moves were smarter than others. It was all right. I'd be perfectly happy to play Feed the Kraken. I'd much rather play Feed the Kraken than Secret Hitler, for what it's worth. But it also has all of the same baggage as Secret Hitler, aside from the historical theming. Namely, player elimination, the random draws, the information noise, weird special abilities, what have you. So, it was all right. It was okay. But as somebody who really likes social deduction games, it was not among my favorite. This was designed by Michael Chaney, Dr. Hans Joachim Ho, and Tobias Imich, published by Fun Tales after successful crowdfunding. Feed the Kraken.
We were lucky enough to get Lagrange Deluxe Master Set back to the table. I guess it's sort of like, you know, 51st State Master Set, because it has its own BGG entry, so therefore it must be a completely different game.
For the Mastery.
For the Mastery. This is put out by Board and Dice and designed by Michael Keller, Andreas Ode, and a whole bunch of other people.
Yes, many of whom contributed a bonus card or a bonus tile to the many modules. We have still not tried any of the modules.
Oh, we play base game.
We are free of the module.
But has all sorts of nice wooden tiles that totally add to the game and would be unplayable without.
Yes. This is very much deluxification for the sake of deluxification.
Yeah, it adds nothing. So the main conceit of Lagrange is these multi-use cards. They have four different uses, and they're going to tuck into the four sides of your player board. And depending on which side you tuck them in, they give you something different. In the end, it is managing your deliveries, I think, is what it boils down to. The end is figuring out how best to get all of the goods that you're producing, making sure you're producing enough of them, and getting them out to where they need to go. You can do personal deliveries, and there's all sorts of different deliveries you can do to the board, and it's all about action, efficiency, and trying to get the most points.
I have two relatively substantial, shall we say, dispreferences with respect to Lagrange. I enjoy it. It's well done, and I do like the fundamental way goods move around your player board and how that interacts with making deliveries, and I fundamentally approve of the basic economy of Lagrange, but I have two objections. One of them is that it doesn't lean enough into its cool card mechanisms. You know, comparing it to a very different game but has the same fundamental conceit with respect to cards, something like Cryo. In Cryo, you get a lot more card actions. More cards drawn, more cards played, more ability to interact with that aspect of things. I understand how the economy is balanced in Lagrange, but, you know, it costs a card action to put out a market stall, which is how you make deliveries, one of the ways you make deliveries, I should say, or to get special abilities, or even just to make a field. And making a field is great, but if you think over the course of the game you're only going to have a small number of card actions, maybe, I don't know, your basic six plus maybe another 3 to 6 on top of that, it feels like you're wasting your time and you don't get to play with a lot of the toys. I would feel better if it leaned into that. You had more card actions, if the economy were recalibrated so you could just play more with those cards.
I agree, because the deck is, because they're all multi-use cards, the deck is gigantic. And on every single card, there is like an Agricola-style special ability. So you hardly ever get to see any of them because you're always using them for something else. And it'd be interesting to see more of those special abilities come into play.
Slightly more customization of your farm board, slightly less friction in terms of being putting out new things that you can use to satisfy orders. Anyway, the other objection I have to Lagrange, and I really felt it this time, is it is so structure heavy. The turn structure is laboriously complicated and it just creaks under its own weight. We've seen, again, I'll point to Cryo again. I very much prefer it in Euro games where you start the game and people just keep taking turns until the game ends. That is absolutely my preferred structure. Now, sometimes you can't do that. You need an income phase, you need a cleanup or something along those lines. But even then, sometimes you have a very, very complex game like Barrage, for example, where most of the time you're doing actions, you do a couple quick things in between, then you go, you're off onto the next round. in the context of the Grandhards, it's almost like there's no core mechanism. Yeah, you're drafting dice, but your drafted dice honestly sometimes feel like they represent a minority of the things you actually do. There's the phase where everyone gets to play a card, and then you get your income, and then various things happen in your fields, and then there are the tiles, and then you do other tiles, and then there's you do the dice. The dice may involve other cards or goods, but maybe not. Sometimes it's another thing. It might let you do a delivery, but then you go on to the other part of the delivery, and during the other part of the delivery, you do your free deliveries first in turn order, and then you do your paid deliveries, unless, of course, you get a free delivery during the paid. Look, it's not complicated. It's just cumbersome.
Yes.
And if you don't have somebody driving the turn structure, it's going to take a long time because, again, lots of small steps done in turn order bloats the length of a game considerably. And I felt that also in Grandhards. So someone has to drive it real hard. All right. Next. I don't like driving. I don't like being driven, but you kind of have to do it unless you want this game that is fundamentally 75 to 90 minutes of decision-making drag on into 2 hours. And so I think there's lots of room for trimming. I think it could be a lot cleaner. I think it could lead into its strengths. So while I fundamentally enjoy La Granja, I think it's not living up to its maximum potential. I'm not angry. I'm just disappointed.
Just so. So here's a game that I was not disappointed in, and you get to do actions and has very little maintenance phase. It's called Sand. This is the new Devier game designed by new designers Ariel D. Ascenso and Javier Pellerazzi. Man, sorry I've ruined your game. This is the first of the ruining, as we call it. And what Sand is at its base is a pickup and deliver game. And what its hook is, or its new mechanism, is has this interesting, you decide what actions you want by sliding down these different colored tokens, and they're going to be actions based on the dice you rolled for that day. And if you pick up certain goods, they're going to block those actions. So you're going to have less actions to do the more goods you're carrying. So in way, it gave me this Marco Polo feel, this sort of like hindering movement and trying to figure out how to get the best out of the move, you know, moving across the map to try to get out of the way of the other players because you want to do things without them stealing the goods that you need. And there's all sorts of special abilities and you're unlocking all sorts of stuff on your board. I got to play it twice. We also streamed it. So if you want to watch me play it with some of the other crew, it is on our YouTube live channel. Overall, I very enjoyed both plays of Sand.
I think the comparison to The Voyages of Marco Polo is somewhat apt because we've complained a lot in the past about games where it felt like you were doing nothing but just laboriously getting from point A to point B. You know, Beast was a recent example of this where you're just, you know, you got this hand of cards and more or less all you're going to be doing is exhausting them just so you can get to the other end of the map, only to discover that your princess is in another castle. And there are a couple of ways that you can mitigate this in a game design. One of them is making it so that it's expensive, but it doesn't feel like that's the sum total of what you're doing. And one of the ways you can do that is make sure that there's something interesting to do along the way or once you get there. And I think that Sand does a reasonably good job of this, as does The Voyages of Marco Polo. Again, traveling is very, very expensive in both instances. In the case of Sand, it's that you're kind of driving your big worm to death because it's this sort of vaguely science fiction / mythology sandworms in the desert vibe. And the sandworms are adorable.
They are?
The artwork is very striking. The characterizations are very, very good. And the worms are very cute.
It is in the same world as Botoku. So anyone who's played Botoku, it says.
Yeah, but the other side of the world from Botoku.
Yes.
Botoku is very lush and green and verdant.
Yes.
Sand is not so, as you might expect.
It gets where you don't want it to be.
Don't sand. You dare.
It's very, oh, sorry.
Don't you dare.
It's very gritty.
Stop it. And I fundamentally enjoyed how it was difficult but doable and not necessarily cumbersome. You know, sometimes it you feel like you're spending your entire turn doing something and you're just moving in sand. There's other things to be done. And it is very much a pick up and deliver game. One of the things I found a little counterintuitive, I don't know if I like it or don't, I just found it striking, was that a lot of the time you're not satisfying recipes. A lot of pick up and deliver games, you're trying to satisfy recipes, very much in vogue in Euro design. But in Sand, you're not. You're cashing in various goods for just straight victory points. But much of the income you're going to get from those deliveries have less to do with the value of the goods themselves and more to do with the fact that whenever you make a delivery of a cube, it slots into your board and covers up a bonus. So, for example, the asking price of a given cube at a city, if it's a cube they like, they might give you 3 points. If it's a cube they don't like, it might give you 1 point. But on your board, once it hits your board, it's going to be worth the 5. So you're not selling it for 3 versus 1. You're selling it for 8 versus 6. And at that point, selling for 6 seems like a good idea in a lot of instances.
Yeah, I think that was the difference between the two plays that I had. It's like when you look at the board, like you said, you go back to other recipe fulfillments. It's like, well, they want those 2 cubes, so I'm going to do everything I can to get those
exactly.
2 cubes. But in the end, it really doesn't matter, and you really should just be delivering whatever.
It's not that it doesn't matter at all.
No,
yeah.
But I mean, deliver action efficiency is more important, is getting cubes onto your board, because in the end, you're just going to get more for filling your board faster.
Right. Now, obviously, the precise nature of the trade-offs is probably more subtle than that, because in addition to the goods that are easily available, there are the more complicated goods. And as is very much in keeping with my general strategy in games, I nickel and dimed my way to whatever remotely passes for whatever success I'm able to get. And there is the possibility of being very careful, leaning into those specific demands that cities have, and then getting these more valuable cubes and cashing them in for perhaps better rewards. That was not my style. That's not what I did. But I'm nonetheless curious, when going back to a second play, whether that would seem more viable or more doable without hurting my head too much in terms of the combinatoric puzzles of it all. My chief objection to Sand was that I thought it was too long.
It's true.
What can I say?
In 3 players, which we played, it does have that extra round, whereas if you play 4, it only has 5 rounds. Another callback to Marco Polo is the fact that everyone starts with this power, which is game-breaking and very powerful.
I think it's less game-breaking than Marco Polo, but it is very pronounced. Yes.
And so there's a whole bunch of things we're not talking about. There's like you're leaving songs, you're doing all these different things, and the fact that the rule book is mostly all painful. Like I said, I don't know if we said it in the show before, but it has like a disclaimer at the start of the rule book, and that's always a bad sign. It says like, oh, this is how we laid out this rule book, and it's like, uh-oh. And that has these like weird and big, like we talked about, it's pick up and deliver. So you're sort of moving as one turn. And then there's a special ability that says, as you pass through
as
a town.
As you pass through, yeah.
And it's like, what does pass through mean? And
right.
So there's a lot of things like that with not enough examples, not enough explanation. But very much looking forward to future plays of Sand.
And also props to Devir Games. They continue to make very physically attractive games with a non-trivial number of even custom components in relatively small boxes. This is much bigger of a box than, say, Red Cathedral, but it is definitely a lot smaller than, say, even something like Feed the Kraken, which very much could have been a small box game.
And definitely does not have room for even a single module. Like, no expansions for this.
Oh, the Majules. Well, no, they expanded the Red Cathedral.
They did. It would not fit in the box.
I know.
That's Sand.
That is Sand. Those are the games we played last week. Now a quick break while we pay some bills. This week's episode is sponsored by Incogni. Every time I've been to a bank in the past year, I've overheard someone ask if a recent phishing email or text or other message they've received has actually been from their bank. I get it. These scammers have powerful tools at their disposal, thanks to data brokers that traffic in your private information without your knowledge. The good news is that you have access to tools, too. Incogni is a service that automatically removes your private data from the brokers that are all too happy to sell your privacy away as though you were the product. And since these data brokers can scrape your data again without your permission, Incogni will keep getting that data removed as many times as it takes while you have a subscription. Ever since I signed up with Incogni, I've had a drastic decrease in the number of robocalls, spam emails, and other scams from people trying to spoof email addresses of my friends and family. So try Incogni now. Use code ABOUTGAMES at incogni.com/aboutgames to get an exclusive 60% off an annual Incogni plan. That's code ABOUTGAMES at incogni.com/aboutgames. It's all too easy to spend over $100 a month on streaming services. Netflix, Disney+, Prime, you name it. But if you use ExpressVPN, you can cut back to just Netflix and save a bundle every month. You can use ExpressVPN to change your online location to over 100 different countries and access the unique media libraries available in those regions. No more having content hidden from you. ExpressVPN is unobtrusive, fast, works on almost any kind of device, all while protecting your privacy online. I've been hearing rave reviews about Scavenger's Reign, and thanks to ExpressVPN, I've been watching it on American Netflix. Like anime? Well, pretend to be the UK, and you can watch the original Cowboy Bebop, not that other version. It's so simple. You just open the app, select a country, and refresh your browser to be wherever you want and watch what people in your country normally can't. So go for it. Get access to more and pay less. Get your money's worth at expressvpn.com/sowronggames. Don't forget to use my link at expressvpn.com/sowronggames to get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN for free. And we're back. Now on to the news and why it doesn't matter.
If you like Calico, they're coming out with a new game. It's called Knitting Circle. It is a Calico-based game, I guess.
Okay.
So
Calico already had lots of knitting.
You really like spatial puzzles, so I'm sure you're going to love...
Look, Calico is one of those very clear examples of an extremely well-done design that has a minimum of rules to a maximum of gameplay tension that is exactly not what I want to do. As a reminder, it physically gave me a headache.
So I'm not sure if it's going to be a game that they're just using the Calico name because Calico was fairly popular.
Right.
So it's just like another Azul sort of,
here's
a game that's in the Azul universe. Yep. But anyway, Knitting Circle from the people that gave us Calico.
GMT is a wargame publisher that has published a number of titles that I very, very much enjoy. And every once in a while, they try, with varying degrees of success, to publish a crossover game that will appeal to the non-wargamers. And they're going to be publishing a game by Richard Garfield?
Is that a new designer? Or?
No, the inventor of magic, Richard Garfield. Yeah.
Thanks.
So he's going to be designing a game called Founders of Ravik, which apparently is going to be a management economic game that is in part based on the insights of some Nobel Prize-winning economists. It seems like a more complicated Euro-style game than Richard Garfield has traditionally designed. He's mostly known for his lighter stuff. I mean, even when he does more straightforward Euro stuff that isn't like Roborally, it still tends to be at a relatively light level.
Yeah,
like
Keyforge was very light.
Well, Keyforge is not a Euro, so.
Oh, sorry.
But yes, in terms of the card battlers that he's been designing, yes, Keyforge is much stripped down when compared to Magic, as well as Mindbug, which is sort of the two-player card battling game stripped down to its barest essentials, could not get more stripped down in a lot of ways without hitting our territory or Brave Rats. But setting all that aside, so this is an unusual pairing. This is an unusual design remit from, nonetheless, a very talented and interesting designer. So I'm very curious to see what Richard Garfield and GMT have up their sleeves with Founders of Ravik.
Speaking of things that are based on stuff, there's a solo game coming out, Mark, called Winston 1984.
Yeah, board gaming has jumped the shark, Walker.
I know, right?
Yeah.
So I thought you'd find this interesting. Do you have this on your list as well?
I do.
All right, I'll let you go on about it then.
So have you read 1984, Walker?
Back in high school.
Yeah.
So back when Stick Stick Rock Rock came out.
Yeah. So in this solo game called Winston 1984... the victory condition is you get to go to the Golden Country, which I would like to note in the context of the book was a made-up place that did not exist and that escape from Big Brother was impossible.
Well, probably in the game as well.
Maybe, who knows? But I don't know what this portends. I can only imagine that in the future we're going to have more solo games based on great works of literature, one where Ahab and the whale resolve their differences through anger management, and that's the victory condition.
I'd play that.
A version of No Exit, where the real exit is the friends you make along the way. Sisyphus finishes up his landscaping at long last. Or possibly my personal favorite, I have a mouth and don't need to scream. Like, I don't get it. This is so strange and absurd. This is almost what I would do as a parody of a great work of literature. Well, not even a great work of literature, a great work of political satire as solo game. I don't like, now maybe the game itself.
Lord of the Flies, a skirmish game. That'd be amazing.
No, that would at least be playing into the theme of the game about how everything is terrible and nightmarish. Like a sort of a Meltwater-style skirmish game where everything you do makes you feel awful about yourself and the world. That I'd totally be down for because that would be in keeping with the tone of the game and of the work that it's riffing on. Now, maybe this is a heavily satirical work. Maybe this is maybe the quote-unquote victory isn't really a victory. I don't know. On the face of it, though, this seems desperately weird.
Agreed. I knew you'd love it.
Love is not the word I'd use.
So we played Expeditions. Expeditions was a Stonemaier game that came out, and we didn't hate it. It's going to have a expansion called Gears of Corruption. So more for expeditions, more cards. And I'm happy for the people that enjoyed expeditions. And lastly, Radlands is getting an expansion, question mark. So they've put out a 1.2 sort of rule book because there's been some sort of feedback on how some of the bases, and it's mostly based around the healing properties of stuff.
Yes.
So they've decided that they're, I just didn't say they're going to scrap. But anyway, this expansion is a whole new deck of bases, which is going to replace the ones that are there.
I can get behind that.
And so it's going to be available at Gen Con.
That was my big complaint against Radlands. It felt grindingly attritional in a lot of ways. And yes. So
they've heard I'd the complaints, and now they're coming back with a probably just remove that whole healing part of it. And the new rule is you cannot heal yourself. Is the quick fix.
You can
fix.
Heal your opponent?
No, well, you can heal other cards.
Oh, the unit can't heal itself, right.
Cards can't heal themselves.
Yeah. Right.
So that's the base fix. We'll have that fix probably just in print now on these new cards.
All right. That is the news and why it doesn't matter. Our topic, Walker, why don't you introduce the topic?
Well, Mark, I think I just want to reflect on where I am now in this gaming sphere, as it were, and how much I'm enjoying this new, I don't need to play every game that's out there, and how it sort of makes me feel about things that are going on, because there's so many games out there, and I sort of just reflect, it's like, I wish we could just play games, like individual games more, because there's so many, not only modules, but you know, starting way the games start up, the new different setups, different characters you can play, different strategies you can employ, and how you can bring out what the designer was trying to get at with multiple plays. Not that games need the multiple plays to enjoy them, but to sort of see the vision that designers had, but through multiple plays. And it's mostly just about sort of like a pushback against consumerism as well. You know, that there's so many games out there that are just copying what other games already do. That's the title.
That's the title. Because you had suggested multiple titles.
I did.
The one that broke the Kallax is back. Or I think we're good. Or it's just Monopoly all the way down. Or you're not getting a new one until you finish the ones you've got.
Yes.
Sometimes I make the mistake, listeners, of asking Walker to offer a pithy title. And I am certainly not in a position to criticize somebody with coming up an overly cumbersome name for something. After all, I am the one who named the podcast. But then Walker will typically reply with a title that is longer than the summary of the topic he proposed.
So this is what I proposed. I'll read that. How about I just read exactly what I proposed to you? A comprehensive look on why do we need new games? With videos and movies and shows, once you've watched them, you've seen them, you don't need to watch them again. With video games, once you've played through them, they're done. So many board games can be played in different ways. Openings, like I've already talked about, so I won't go over that again. So that's how I envisioned it. And then today when I was thinking about it, I'm wondering if board games are a little bit more like music, because I didn't even mention music there, right? Where a lot of music is being compared to be as just the same, but just like a different riff on different.
A trap beat with a heavily distorted. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So I'm wondering if maybe board games are more in the music genre where it's just sort of, you know, you're sort of mixing it up a little bit and less like those other medias that I've talked about.
Okay. Well, first of all, I kind of reject the premise that with which you frame books, movies, and television, because I definitely think that if it's a quality work, it's going to reward repeated.
True, but much less so.
I'm not sure that's true. I'm not sure that I reject the premise that the very best of movies give you no more on repeat watchings than repeat plays of the very worst of games, right? So on the extreme ends, I think that thesis is flatly false and false.
For sure.
All right. So then the question becomes one of degrees. And so already, you know, the paradigm of games are different from, I think, kind of gets weakened, or possibly even if I was interested in being tendentious, which I seldom am, falls apart. But anyway, and I've been thinking a lot about consumerism as well, our role in consumerism, both as consumers and as podcasters. these are things that we take seriously and we talk about rather substantially. Here's the thing, though. Let me start off with a bit that is counter to, I think, your noble impulses, but I nonetheless think is acceptable. And I'll start with books. I'll move on to games. There are people with books on their shelves, and we know for a fact, just based on a rudimentary understanding of time, let alone scheduling, that they will never be able to read all their unread books. All right? I don't curate books anymore. The books that I keep are largely the ones that I got in university. So the most influential works on my mindset. I talked about this in a newsletter, actually, where I talked about some of the books that I'd been acquiring recently because I actually lost my copy of The Vocation of Man by Fichte. It was a whole thing. I felt very, very deeply wounded. Anyway, but I know lots of people that go to conventions and go to book festivals, and they just love acquiring new books, and they've got an endless series of novels and other books on their shelves that they know that they will never get to read. And what I'm going to say is, I think that's okay. Now, it's not unproblematic. We'll get to that. I mean, yes, there are economic and environmental costs to all these things. Absolutely 100%, and I'm not blind to that. But the economic costs, at least, are within the realm of the purchaser to evaluate straightforwardly. I'm not, you know, some people may be, in point of fact, addicted and buying themselves into bankruptcy. That's not a good thing. But setting that aside, do you disagree with that proposition that it is okay that someone can derive pleasure and satisfaction, either consciously or unconsciously, from just the acquisition of and display of a book without reading it?
Agreed.
Okay.
But I do want to put a little caveat on that because I'm wondering, there was people that did the same thing with VCR tapes and DVDs.
Yep. Totally.
And the fact that you can just download whatever movie you want now, I'm almost sure that market and that type of hobby has almost disappeared overnight. Right? There's not as many people.
It's certainly a lot lower. There are people who still like physical media.
For sure.
Like in my other hobby of, I'm somewhat of a hobbyist with respect to TV and video, TV and movies. It's a little different. Hobbyism there is different. Some people love still having the physical media. Our friend Louis is one of them. He likes curating and collecting it as well as digitizing it. So he has two parallel libraries, the digital one and the physical one. I used to curate visual media. I stopped about 10 years ago, largely because it got too much of a pain in terms of storage space and transitional difficulties. And people don't make DVD shelves anymore, no. Partially as a result.
And so I'm wondering, because there is a pushback against, you know, these Kindles that you use to read books and just reading books on a screen, right? So I'm wondering if you took out that sort of stigma and people liked reading on digital just as much as they do writing books, I'm wondering if that also would, you know, if not half the number of people that collected books, even further, like it would be even a single percentile of people that would do that kind of thing.
You're saying if there was somehow a way, say by...
No, I just mean like if that stigma was just gone. Say people didn't have that stigma. They enjoyed reading digital just as much as they enjoyed reading physical copies.
I don't know. There is something to the pleasure of being able to have a nicely stocked bookshelf as a effectively a work of art. Because... It's weird. People say, oh, well, you know, you got that book. You're never going to read it. People would never say that about, say, something else you might hang on a wall, like a calendar. It's like, oh, you have a calendar on your wall, but you never use it as a day planner, right? That's absurd. It's like I have hung it not for its utilitarian considerations. I've hung it in part because, I mean, maybe I get some negligible utility out of it. But like I have a calendar, for example, on my wall that literally doesn't have boxes in it. Because it's the French Republican calendar. And so I get to say, it's like, ooh, today was the Maypole day in whatever made up time. I mean, all time is made up. My point is that there's lots of different ways to appreciate an object. And I find that sometimes when it comes to media, people get overly reductive. It's like, why do you need that when you could do the other thing? And in the context of books... Like, why would you get a book that you don't read? Why would you get a book when you can have the PDF? Why would you do, you know? I think there are legitimate grounds and legitimate bases for somebody to prefer having a well-stocked bookshelf or even just as a memento. Like, that's a reason to keep a book around even if you're never going to read it again. It's like this is like an artifact. People keep keepsakes, and true, yeah, books can be that too.
You look over and you see that book, and it reminds you of when you not only precisely. When you read it, but the whole story itself. It's like, oh, that I remember that.
Precisely. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so transitioning back to board games, much of the germ of those insights can be applied to board games. So, for example, it's more I will freely grant, and I'll get back to this later, it's more burdensome with board games because they're more expensive and they're bigger. All right, absolutely. Yes. And the environmental considerations definitely get dialed up to 11. I absolutely agree, 100%. And that is one of the reasons why when games are small box games that could have been big box games, like Devere games or things that are big box games that could be small box games, I point that out. And I personally would be happier if they were smaller. And again, kudos to the publishers of Cascadero. It could have been a big box game. It was very, very small, you know, a lot of, anyway.
And also to CGE quickly, because they've developed this, that new technology that they put in Kutrohora, where it's repurposed wood that's now injected into these pieces.
Oh yeah, totally.
They look like plastic, but it's not. Yeah.
And the people moving away from shrink wrap and the people who recognize that spot UV coating is a bad idea, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There are things that can be done, but here's the thing. There is this assumption in the hobby that the person who buys a board game and never plays it, that is somehow fundamentally some great tragedy. I don't think that's necessarily the case. Number one, it is good to have options. And so sometimes just having the option, even if it's not taken, it's the same reason why, and you've expressed this on behalf, like if you bring a big bag full of games to a game day and you don't play any of them, some people are like, oh, sorry, you brought all those games. Like, no, it's good to have the option. I don't mind the opportunity cost. I feel the same way about sometimes acquiring the game if that's the only way to get it locally.
Yeah, as long as it doesn't get too out of hand.
Of course. You seem to think that amongst the two of us.
I think this is just reflecting on the buildup is starting again, right? I now have piles.
Yep.
In random places. I now have no more shelf space. And so this is all sort of, I think, building back on and adding pressure and getting worried about, once again, I have all of these games and I don't want all of these games.
So I think it's worth flagging something that I think has been very much implicit in this conversation, as well as all of our conversations on similar topics. We are not representative of many hobbyists in that we have additional cross-cutting pressures on our acquisition. Before we were podcasters, we engaged in a certain amount of churn. And you could feel good or bad about that level of churn, and I could issue some justifications hypothetically for some level of churn. You could feel bad about running out of shelf space and so forth. But now we have additional pressures. We would be, to a certain extent, not producing content of the type that some of our listeners want if we stopped talking about new games altogether, which we could absolutely do.
Yes.
Between just the games that we have, we could stop getting games for the rest of our hobby existences and play games regularly at the same rate and never get a new one. And probably we'd be perfectly happy to do so. At least let me rephrase that. We would feel the pang of, oh, David Thompson's got this new thing. We would feel the pang of, oh, that dexterity game looks amazing. We would feel the pang of this, that, and the other. But in terms of actual our satisfaction of playing the games, I don't think we would necessarily lose a whole heck of a lot.
No, and that's just the thing. The glut is so huge. There's so many more games coming out. So I find myself reading so many more rule books than I normally
would. That's true. That is a burden.
To try to filter out some of these. Now I'm reaching out to other content creators to try to get, you know, like an exchange thing going on.
Yeah, it's a shame that we don't do that more often. Yeah.
And even to the local group, it's like if I see a game that I'm interested in, I always send out an email. Does anyone have this yet?
Right.
And we have done that a couple times, like with Beast and other games, we've got them without having to purchase them. So I just need to sort of focus on trying to, because a lot of times.
And back in the US, I was able to do this far more often with trading. Trading on Board Game Geek is a very, very good way to.
Because I love playing new games, but a lot of times we only get to play them once. And then, yeah.
Here's the thing. One of the joys that I derive from this hobby is being able to experience new systems, frankly. And there are some games where repeat play genuinely shows you new systems. Root is an example that springs to mind, because not just every individual faction, but just the interaction between factions leads to very, very striking new dynamics. as much as I love Through the Desert and would happily play Through the Desert almost endlessly, and it's one of what I think one of the greatest designs of the modern hobby, it doesn't necessarily introduce new systems. It introduces new game states. And I absolutely love seeing new game states and watching new permutations of the existing systems. But here's the thing. What I would be losing if I played Through the Desert every, you know, twice every week for the rest of my hobby existence, that just knocked out either one or two new games that I could be trying, I would be experiencing fewer new systems. I would be experiencing fewer ways for someone to try to render something into numbers, fewer ways for someone to try to rethink how auctions might work, rethink how player interaction can be nudged, or a board could be developed, or a tableau could be built. I mean, and it is through the search of some of those new experiences that drives me to contribute to this level of churn. And I very much don't like the burden that it inflicts, but I feel like I'm getting something out of it. And so I think ultimately, as much as I very much appreciate the desire to go back into the back catalog, re-experience all those things that we know to be excellent, rather than a shot in the dark on something that's probably just going to be fine, and I'm not necessarily going to defend the extent to which I go and acquire or seek out new games, I think it's important to recognize that there is some virtue there, and there is something there that a new game can offer that old games necessarily are less able to.
Agreed. And just reading the rule book, it makes it very hard as well, because you can see certain mechanisms and you can think that that's something new and you want to know how it develops.
Yeah. How it actually shakes out.
Exactly.
Yes, absolutely.
And so you just purchase it on that stance alone and hopefully it does manifest itself.
Look, a lot of these burdens would be lessened if we lived in a larger city. A lot of these burdens would be lessened if we lived in the United States and had access to comparatively cheaper trading options. A lot of these burdens would be lessened if there were major local conventions that happened on a regular basis. I mean, look, there are lots of ways that you can do this.
Which focuses back on this is a more of a me problem. I'm not saying this is a problem that other people have.
Yeah.
To lesser or more extents. I'm just saying this is something that I'm feeling at the moment.
Okay. So do you have any notion about how you are going to try to address this issue that you're having? Just out of curiosity, because I know that a lot of listeners and a lot of hobbyists feel that same, I guess, angst would be a good way to put it, that you are feeling right now.
No, we're just going to go for a bigger reduction. Like I said, I've reached out to some other content creators about trading these new releases.
Yep.
Because a lot of us only play it once.
It's true.
So we can talk about it. And then...
Well, definitely a lot of us, even the ones we play more than once, there is often a definite time when we're done with them. That's for sure.
And then I think there's just going to be another large culling, where I'm going to collect a bunch of stuff and go to a local convention that has a bring and buy and just say, thank you.
Yes. Yes. Part of me wonders ultimately whether whether my disambiguation of the consumerism burdens and the hobbyist burdens is appropriate, because basically, to sum up everything that I've been saying, there's a difference between the concern about consumerism and the concern about the churn itself, because I agree with you, the consumerist aspect of constantly buying new stuff is unfortunate and wasteful, and there are a lot of ways around it. But that in effect is different from the drive to play new games. For us, it's conjoined just because of the circumstances we're in. But for a lot of people who live in larger hobbyist communities, they don't have to worry about that as much. And there are lots of hobbyists that buy zero new games and yet complain about not playing the same game more than once because they're surrounded by other people that are engaged in similar parts of the churn. And I'm very sympathetic to the consumerist concerns. But personally, given my tastes, as much as I would love to play older games more often, and I make the effort, and I'm more successful than I've been in the past to a large extent, But I nonetheless think that there is a legitimate value in trying new games.
I agree. And just to bring it back, because it might have sounded a little bit negative, but at the beginning, I did state that I'm enjoying playing games a lot more lately.
Good.
Because I have not been getting in more new games. There's been like the overflow from last year from Kickstarters that have been coming in, but that will slowly peter out, and just being more selective and not having, you know, packages showing up every day. Now they're just showing up every other day.
Whereas on my part, I would just like to emphasize that we do this for the listeners.
So ultimately, it's your fault. Just saying, yeah.
We bleed for them. We suffer for them. It is the sacrifice we make for our art and for our listenership.
Just so.
And yet I never complain.
Yeah. So I'm guilt-free. It's not my fault.
Well, that's going to do it for this episode of So Very Wrong About Games. Thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate your deciding to support us with your very valuable time, and we appreciate it very sincerely. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can find all our contact information at sowronggames.com and a whole bunch of other entertaining, diverting, and useful information besides. Hope to see you again soon. Please take care.
Peace!
And thank your rules explainer.
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark Biggin. Special thanks goes to What Does It Eat for generously allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our theme. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. You can reach us by email at soveryronggames@gmail.com or on Twitter at sowronggames. Thanks very much, see you next time, and always, try to be right, but remember you are so very wrong.